Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Beyond the surface, understanding and managing insomnia.
Insomnia is a highly prevalent condition in Australia. In fact, for six consecutive years, the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners Health of the Nation survey found sleep disturbance to be one of the top two most common presenting symptoms in general practice patients. Insomnia can be debilitating and often leads to a reduced quality of life. Successful treatment of insomnia not only improves sleep quality overnight, but can also subsequently improve the management of comorbid disorders, including depression. Despite the individual and societal burden from insomnia, studies have shown relatively few people still seek help for insomnia. Effective treatment of insomnia is complicated by two important considerations: the under-recognition and under-diagnosis of insomnia, and the heterogeneous treatment pathways available. Today we're speaking with Dr. David Cunnington. He's a sleep physician based on the Sunshine Coast, and we'll be speaking about insomnia management. Welcome to Drive Time GP, David.
Thanks, Brad.
So, David, most people are likely to suffer from the odd bad night's sleep at some point, but many people tend to use insomnia as an umbrella term to describe this bad sleep. Can you start off by telling us what's the actual medical definition of insomnia?
So there's a DSM-5 definition of insomnia, and that's characterized by difficulties with sleep occurring at least 3 nights a week for 3 months or more when circumstances and opportunities for sleep are ideal. And then there's an important additional part to that is that it's impacting on daytime functioning. Now, lots of us have sleep disturbance. Lots of us may have the sleep we sort of wish we had better sleep, longer sleep, maybe weren't awakening. But think of that as there's a lot of sleep dissatisfaction around with not being able to meet this idealized sleep of we all should get 8 hours and not wake up during the night, which really is an idealized norm rather than really what sleep is.
Can you tell us how prevalent the actual definition, the medical definition of insomnia is within the Australian population?
There's been a study done by the Sleep Health Foundation back in 2019 that showed that around 23% of the population would have met that diagnostic criteria for chronic insomnia. Now, acute insomnia, that's really common. Most of us will get a period of acute insomnia that's short-term, self-limited, at least once every year. But that chronic insomnia where people have still disturbed sleep despite everything else being stable, think of that as about 20% of the population.
I suppose a lot of people just think, if I've had insomnia last night, I'll feel a bit grumpy in the morning, and that's one of those short-term health outcomes. But can you take us through a few of the other short-term and the longer-term outcomes or impacts of insomnia that people experience?
Long-term insomnia has very significant consequences. There's associations with increased risk of hypertension, artery disease, heart failure, other cardiovascular morbidity and mortality, and altered glucose metabolism and diabetes. From a mental health point of view, there's a strong two-way relationship between insomnia and mental health, such as depression and anxiety, with disturbed sleep and insomnia increasing the risk of depression and anxiety, and likewise depression and anxiety increasing insomnia, which then feeds back to increased depression and anxiety. So chronic insomnia has consequences, and that's something we come back to because it's really important when we think about treatment options. Because often, particularly in primary care, we're very averse to risk when thinking about insomnia, but we've got to realise that insomnia itself comes with risk. So we can't have a sort of no-risk appetite when we think about managing it.
Well, certainly insomnia isn't a trivial condition, and sometimes in general practice I feel like every single patient has been telling me about their problems with insomnia. Can you talk us through the treatment options that are available to GPs for managing this condition?
So when we think about insomnia, really the first line therapy for chronic insomnia should be non-drug strategies like cognitive behaviour therapy for insomnia. Really good research showing that it's an effective strategy that helps to change the way people think and behave around sleep. And often change thinking and behaviour has set up a self-perpetuating cycle of poor sleep over time. Unfortunately, though, cognitive behaviour therapy doesn't work for everybody. And even if people get a response to cognitive behaviour therapy, there's a significant proportion of people who will still have ongoing symptoms. So whilst cognitive behaviour therapy is a great starting point, one of the issues has been accessibility. There are limited practitioners available in Australia who have specific skills in cognitive behaviour therapy for insomnia. The Australasian Sleep Association and professional bodies have been very proactive in recent years of trying to upskill people, but there still is a skill deficit, so that's been an issue. But cognitive behaviour therapy for insomnia takes time, and it takes people putting in some effort, being motivated to change, and it's not something that's going to give an immediate result. And like a lot of psychological interventions, if people have high levels of distress, they often will need some pharmacotherapy to sit alongside that psychologically based therapy. Interestingly, when you look at what actually happens in primary care, there's good research in Australia showing that around 90% of people with insomnia are managed with pharmacotherapy. And common medications that are used and are approved for the treatment of insomnia include benzodiazepines, the benzodiazepine receptor agonists, the Z drugs, zopiclone and zolpidem, melatonin, the dual orexin receptor antagonist, or DORAs, and some other medications, including sedative antidepressants. Now, that research in Australia has shown benzodiazepines are the most widely used and prescribed medications, but as we know, they're not without their problems in terms of concerns about dependency, tolerance, and not necessarily replicating normal sleep architecture. The Z drugs also have good research showing short-term effectiveness, but their indication is for a four-week indication, and we also have some concerns over time about dependence and tolerance. Melatonin, available as Cicadin, as one of the brands in an extended-release formulation, is approved for the treatment of insomnia in people over the age of 55. One of the potential attractions of melatonin is a perception that it's better tolerated than some of the other medications, but there are issues with lack of data on long-term efficacy with medications like melatonin. The dual orexin receptor antagonists are a class of medication specifically designed to treat insomnia. They have a different mechanism of action from benzodiazepines and the Z drugs. Rather than working via a GABA-mediated mechanism to induce sleep, they work more via reducing the wakefulness drive. But really the key is recognising we have a range of tools available to manage insomnia, and it's trying to work with that individual person who's got insomnia to match the tools we use with what's going on. And it's also important to think of it in a multifaceted sort of way. For example, I saw someone earlier today who had insomnia, has been really done a lot of CBT, worked very hard on that for a number of years. But when you take a step back and look at what's driving insomnia, she actually had undiagnosed ADHD for many years. That's really the driver for her insomnia. So that needs to be managed in terms of managing things rather than just continually focusing on the CBTI and just an insomnia framework.
You previously mentioned the dual orexin receptor antagonists, or DORAs for short. Now, this class of medication has been around for nearly a decade in Australia, but they've got a very different action. They're a little bit more unique compared to other medications that have been on the market. Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
So think of orexin as a master neurotransmitter that's involved in promoting wakefulness. So if you have a medication that binds to the orexin receptor, so orexin receptor 1 and orexin receptor 2, and partially blocks those receptors, it'll reduce the activity of the orexin system. Now, that results in a reduction in wakefulness drive, hence a sleep effect. And that effect, unlike the effect mediated via the GABA mechanism, which is the more benzodiazepines and Z drug effects, is much more neutral on sleep architecture. So it doesn't appear to have the same impact on sleep architecture, and clinical trials with the dual orexin receptor antagonists have shown preservation of normal sleep architecture. It also doesn't work via a sedative mechanism, which is again that GABA mechanism, which is a very broad receptor or transmitter system right across the neurological system. And so people often feel a little different when they may take the DORAs compared to other medications, but that can also change their tolerability profile and potential for other side effects such as longer-term dependency.
So if you've got orexin that's waking you up and then we're using a blocker of that, you're essentially blocking your wakefulness neurotransmitter. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really nice way of thinking about it. And it is a totally different approach to how we've previously thought about sleeping medications, which are more about promoting the sleepiness drive.
And you mentioned that people sometimes feel a bit different using medications that are the dual orexin receptor antagonists. How do they feel different compared to other medications that they may have used previously?
Yeah, as I was talking about, medications that act via the GABA receptor, such as the benzodiazepines, often have that global CNS sedation effect. So people have that sense of just lack of awareness of things, the black curtains come down, time's passed, I know nothing of what happened, therefore it must have been good sleep. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it's good sleep, because in actual fact, normal sleep isn't that total unawareness of things. So with a dual orexin receptor antagonist, it's much more common for people to, and often early, undervalue their effect and say, well, I was still aware of things and therefore it probably didn't do anything. But in actual fact, in the clinical trials, when you look at the objective sleep data, sleep's improved to the similar magnitude to the other medications in clinical trials, but it doesn't feel that same unawareness of things. So I find that really helpful in clinical practices, just counselling people not to expect that sense of sedation or unawareness that may associate with other medications they've trialled.
There are two DORAs available, with Devigo or Lemborexant being the most recent. Now, can you give us an overview of the efficacy of Lemborexant for the treatment of insomnia?
So in multiple clinical trials, lemborexant's been shown to provide significant effect for reducing both time to get to sleep, so we call that sleep onset, and the amount of wakefulness, reducing the amount of wakefulness during sleep, so we call that sleep maintenance. Some of the clinical trials, for example, the Sunrise 2 was a 12-month study showing that the benefits continued out to 12 months. And although lemborexant is generally well tolerated, the most common adverse events to look out for are somnolence or sleepiness, headache, and abnormal dreams. In the clinical trials, there was no evidence of withdrawal or rebound insomnia following discontinuation of lemborexant. An important thing for me when I think about who I'm going to manage with medications as well is that in the key clinical trials for lemborexant, there are a number of older adults included in those trials, and they defined that as over the age of 65. In Sunrise 2, it was around a quarter of the study population were over the age of 65, showing good efficacy and were also well tolerated in that older population group as well, which is often a patient group where you're worried about drug interactions, you're worried about falls risk, you're worried about cognitive impairment, all things that were shown not to be a significant factor with lemborexant in those clinical trials.
Well, can you tell us where DORAs may play a role in clinical practice and who are the patients that would be suitable for DORAs and how do you start patients on them?
So when I'm managing someone with insomnia, I'm taking that sort of high-level look at what are going to be the potential contributing factors to insomnia and look at addressing those. I'm going to be looking at how they think and behave around sleep and trying to use cognitive behaviour therapy to recalibrate that and reduce those perpetuating factors. And then if there's still ongoing issues, and particularly if I suspect I'm going to need something to manage sleep over a long period of time, more than 4 weeks, that's really where I think the DORAs have a great role. Because of the clinical trial data for longer-term efficacy and their indication not being time-limited like the other medications, I'm much more comfortable being able to use the DORAs over a longer period of time. My own clinical practice, again, as a bit I've alluded to, people who are complex, maybe on multiple other medications or older with more comorbidities, is another group I'm much more comfortable with using the DORAs. Now, there are some contraindications. So because the DORAs work by suppressing orexin or partially antagonising the orexin receptor, people who have low levels of orexin, which is a condition of narcolepsy with cataplexy, can get worsening symptoms of narcolepsy with orexin, dual orexin receptor antagonists. Like all medications, if we're using the DORAs, we should start at the lowest recommended dose, so for lemborexant is 5 milligrams. But if it's been well tolerated and you need greater effect, the dose can be increased to 10 milligrams.
Well, thank you so much, David, for talking about insomnia and the treatment options that are available. Can you summarise some of the key points for our GPs to take from this discussion today?
So as you've talked about, insomnia is really common, particularly in primary care. It's not without risk. So don't be dismissive of insomnia or don't think about, well, I'm only going to use a treatment that has no risk. Because insomnia, chronic insomnia, has significant risk of both physical and mental health illnesses over time. The treatment guidelines rightly recommend that we use a mix of non-pharmacological, so psychologically based approaches and pharmacological approaches. So absolutely, I'll be proactive in using CBTI and looking locally where I can access that or whether I use an online module. And then if we're thinking about a sleep medication, trying to match that medication to the particular profile of the patient, but recognising that most medications aren't approved for use beyond 3 months and the benzodiazepines and Z drugs are only indicated for short-term use, so that if we are needing something that's going to be able to be used over a longer period of time, that's where the DORAs may have a role. And I think a key thing to finish on, Brad, is just to, from a general practice point of view, is if you've been managing it as insomnia and following the things we've talked about and it's not going to plan, the person's not responding, just take a step back and think, is it really insomnia? Is there something underpinning this? And the things that commonly fit that is other causes of hyperarousal, be that anxiety, perfectionistic thinking, obsessional thinking, trauma, neurodiversity. Because a lot of the time I'll be seeing people referred to me in specialist practice where the GP's done all the right things and they haven't responded. And when I take a step back, there's that underlying predisposing factor that's the clue.
Well, thank you so much for taking us through all of these topics on Drive Time GP. Dr. David Cuddington from the Sunshine Coast, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Brett.
This interview forms part one of a two-part series on the management of insomnia. Next time, we'll be diving deep into more patient profiles and looking at what treatment options are the most appropriate for your patients.
Please note, Dovigo Lemborexant is a prescription medicine not PBS listed in Australia and is unfunded in New Zealand. Before prescribing Dovigo, please review the full product information for information on dosage, contraindications, precautions, interactions, and adverse effects available in Australia at either www.asahi.com.au/PI or the Drive Time Radio website, or in New Zealand at www.medsafe.govt.nz. Dovigo is included in the Black Triangle Scheme, as it is subject to additional monitoring in Australia. This will allow quick identification of new safety information. Australian healthcare professionals are asked to report any suspected adverse events at www.tga.gov.au/reporting-problems. Substantiating references can be obtained on the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Asahi Australia Proprietary Limited, South Bank, Victoria, and produced in May 2025. The views expressed are those of the individual speakers and may not represent those of the supporting organisation or Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.